Hello, everyone. You might have seen a write-up of our book in LA Weekly. They said that Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, was rich with context and analysis, gruesome yet all in good fun. We're equal parts thrilled and humbled. Be sure to pick up a print or Kindle copy from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Bear Manor Media. That's Bear as in the Revenant Bear, not naked. Anyway, on with the show.
Speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right!
They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait. There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
He's an artist. He does it with imagination.
I love to see them running. I love the moment of their death when I am one with Zardos. Decaying flesh, the sweet scent of putrefaction already in the air. He's a fine, strong beast, dear May. What exactly do you want to do with him?
Zardoz speaks to you, his chosen ones. You have been raised up from brutality. Kill the brutals who multiply and are legions. This ends, Zardoz, your god, gave you the gift of the gun. The gun is good.
The gun!
Penis is evil. Penis is evil.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 120. John Borman's Sean Connery starring Megabomb, Zardoz.
Well, I mean, you say Megabomb in the sense that, yes, this is one of those movies that is considered to be one of those really awful movies. And in a lot of ways, it is, because when you watch this movie, you're like, what the fuck were they thinking? Who were they? What audience did they have in mind that would respond to this movie?
It has career assassin all over it.
It does, but
Charlotte Rampling and Sean Connery. It's one of these things where you look at it and go, how did they recover to have such indelible, long-lasting careers after this thing that would have sunk lesser, let's say, mere mortal?
Okay, so first of all, you said John Borman, and we gotta say, I mean, this man, you know, he made Excalibur, and he also made one of our mutual favorite films, that being Deliverance. And Deliverance is, of course, based on the James Dickey novel, that was a taut...
Yeah, rip-roaring.
Rip-roaring.
Tightly paced, yeah. Excitement-filled, action yarn, nonpareil, right. This thing is...
I mean, he wrote this movie, so you cannot blame any source. This is John Wharton Zardoz in every single way. He wrote it, he produced it, he directed it. This is unbelievably...
Incomprehensible,
incoherent, and yet at the same time, there's sort of philosophical underpinnings to this that make it worth watching. A lot of people do dismiss Zardoz right off the bat because of the sartorial choices of
Sean Connery. Yeah, I mean, he's decked out in a red codpiece, a bandolier, and ridiculous equestrian boots, and he's basically there in all his 70s hirsute Sean Connery glory, traipsing around post-apocalyptic wasteland, or...
It's not post-apocalyptic.
Future. It's a future.
This is dystopian. This is a dystopian future set in the year 2293. Now, I mean, yes, we talked about Sean Connery's appearance. The man is bedecked. He's ponytailed. He's hirsute, as you said before. He's bedecked in the codpiece. His ass cheeks are hanging out. He's got these bandoliers. I mean...
His ball sack is barely being contained.
Yeah. They, you know what? They talk about that in the movie. There's an analytical examination of Sean Connery's ball sack and the physiological ramifications of the erection, which we'll get to, I guess, in a moment or two to discuss this. You have this actor, this A-list actor, and you're thinking to yourself, like, what the fuck was he thinking? Who the hell thought this was a good idea?
And a callback to Deliverance, because Burt Reynolds was tasked to star as Zed, the protagonist in this film, but luckily for him, bowed out due to illness, and Sean Connery was slated as his replacement.
It's funny you say that, because luckily for him, because to this day, although he hasn't made a movie in quite a while, Sean Connery is still considered to be a bankable movie star, whereas Burt Reynolds is not. But, yeah, somehow he survived this debacle. I mean, the reality of the matter is that this movie, I don't know, sensibilities change, tastes change, but... I can't picture people in 1974 plucking down, you know, going to the box and saying, hey, give me two for Zardoz, sitting down, and unless you're like stone at your gourd, being able, you know, to sit there and watch this fucking thing without getting up and walking out.
Yeah, well, the poster alone, not to mention the title, would be dissuading any ticket buyer. How do you sell this thing? Mm-hmm. What's the tagline? How can you possibly generate an audience for this thing?
Well, it's funny you mentioned the title, because Zardoz is actually a permutation of the Wizard of Oz. If you take away the Wiz and the Of, you get Zardoz. And the Wizard of Oz figures prominently in this plot. This film is about a wizard of certain sorts. I mean, the sense of, like, in the Wizard of Oz, you have a...
A figure, yeah. A figure almost a godlike, like a prime mover who... causes everything to happen from behind
a curtain. Who speaks loudly. But beyond the loud booming voice, there's really nothing there. And with Zardoz, the same thing. The movie starts off with a floating head.
Yeah, like the best movies do.
Exactly. And this floating head, we got this figure, and he says, I am Zardoz. And he's got this painted on, literally, painted on mustache and goatee. And he says, I am I'm a fake god. I'm a puppet master. This film takes place in the future.
So in a possible future, yeah.
These events have yet to occur. And then he even admonishes the viewer, which is hilarious. He goes, is God in showbiz too?
Yeah.
So, I mean, right away, they're drawing some sort of parallel between religion and theatricality and showbiz. And then this takes place in 1993. And it starts off with a bunch of codpiece bedecked, horseback riding stormtroopers. They're all wearing this mask which resembles...
Well, yeah, I would say Greek tragedy, like Sophoclean tragedy masks crossed with stormtroopers from Star Wars, crossed with Mayan fertility gods. I don't know how to describe them. And they're going on a rampage, killing, I guess, the agrarian folk around them on horseback, just shooting them.
The Brutalists, as they were referred to in the movie. And these are the Outlanders, or they come from the Outland, and they worship this god, Zardoz. Now, Zardoz is a gigantic floating stone head, and Zardoz then touches down, and everybody's praying before Zardoz, and he speaks, and he says, the gift I give you guys is the gun. The gun is the gift.
Yes.
The penis is evil. So instead of saying...
A gun is a penis, like maybe your NRA folk would have you believe. These guys, what do they do? Sublimate their sexual urges into violence? Well, is that what they're doing? Yeah.
That's what he's saying. Instead of go forth and multiply, he says, go forth and kill. Because, really, this whole movie, it's one big, weird sort of allegorical kind of... I don't even know how to describe it.
I would say you have the brutalists, mm-hmm. who are our atavistic forebears, our hunter-gatherer types, and the more sophisticated agrarian types who've manufactured a means of survival based on agricultural sustenance. And so they don't have to live off the land in the way the brutalists do, or by pillaging and raping and doing all this stuff. So they have their fortifications, they've got their society structured, and that's what has really made present day agrarian society.
Okay,
makes people live longer, not have to work as hard, that kind of thing. And these two tensions.
But at the same time, then the brutalists are then being hunted down by the Outlanders, who then steal their grain and give it to this Stonehead, this Zardoz. Mm. For that grain to be then taken to the vortex.
Well, you're parsing out a subtlety that was lost on me then. Uh-huh. So you're saying the Outlanders are different from the brutalists.
Oh, indeed.
Oh, okay.
In certain respects, I mean, yes, they do call the Outlanders brutalists, but they're like the police. They're given the guns, and they're the ones that are, yes, they have these slaves that are farmers, and they have to then kill the farmers, steal the grain, give it to Zardoz, give it to...
As an offer.
Yes. Give it to this gigantic stone head, and then this goes, floats up into the, wherever the fuck you want to go, and it's given to the immortals in the vortex. And these are the people that create this utopian society, but it's really not a utopia, it's a dystopia.
Yeah, where everything is, it's a democracy in its purest form, I guess you would say. They vote on every single issue, which is, I guess, what everyone going back to Plato warned about, the perils of a democracy, where the majority tyranny, whatever they say goes. Every issue they have a plebiscite, and some ridiculous hologram appears, and then the yeas have it or the nays have it, and they determine what goes on, every little thing. And like they're an elite as well, so they've delegated the, I guess, more menial tasks, mm-hmm. to others. And this others group is what? Is this the apathetics who work in the mill to produce the...
Well, no, see, because this is a very convoluted movie, right? So, within these vortex dwellers, I mean, they're immortal, right? So, they have found a way to cheat death, to cheat sleep. They don't even sleep. So, they live forever.
They have
no respite from anything. And so, you would think, I mean, their life is perfect, but the reality of the matter is that they, by creating this isolationist utopia, the elitists, you know, they have this interesting sort of tension going on. And whatever happens within the elitist community, if you do something that's considered to be anathema to the society, you are then punished. How are you punished? You're aged.
Yeah, right? Instead of being banished from the city limits of Athens, you are aged. And this would really prevent all criminal recidivism, if you thought about it. If we could do this here in our current society, punishment by age. Maybe a small transgression, you caught graffitiing a building, age you a week.
Right.
Murder somebody, age you 40 years. I mean, we do it to a certain extent in prison, but not. It doesn't have the immediate effect that this has. That was amazing.
But
what a neat thing.
But they're becoming aged, they can't die. They're immortal.
Yeah.
So
you're trapped in just an aged body.
Right. So they've created this society, this vortex, which resides within the force field. And yes, they have their own... It sounds so ridiculous, I know.
Anyway, you know, our mea culpa is up front. We're doing the best we can to parse this thing out. Yeah. Okay.
And
they have the force field.
And they have this, as you said before, this democratic society where they vote on certain things. And Sean Connery, who plays Zed, one of the enforcers, one of the brutalists...
The pure id. Yeah. Like they operate solely on instinct, and they're rapers and pillagers.
Well,
and
that's the thing too, because I mean, these elitists, they've gone beyond sexual urges because they don't die. They have no need to procreate,
mm-hmm.
so they don't need to.
They don't work and they don't have sex, and you'd think not working would lead to more leisure time, but with these guys, it's the opposite. They've being immortal, as you said, would eventually become boring. And we were talking about this earlier in the context of being a vampire.
what do they do all day? They are envious of Zed for his ability to die and ability to do as he pleases.
And they ability have no to get an erection.
Yes.
And they physiologically examine this. Okay, so we're going to have ourselves. So somehow, and it is explained later in the movie, Zed infiltrates this gigantic stone head, this physical manifestation of God.
Of God, who bestows weapons and bullets upon his believers.
Right. And in doing so, he then sees the man that we saw at the very beginning of the movie, the floating head, and his name is actually not Zardoz, he's Arthur Frayn. And he shoots him. So we think that now Arthur Frayn has perished, but whatever. He hasn't, but that's, you know, neither here nor there. And he floats off in his head, and he finds himself in the vortex. They see this man.
I feel like I'm in the vortex right now. But yeah.
they see this hirsute, barely clothed man. They consider him a brutalist, an animal. They actually cage him up.
Yes.
They call him It. And they want to study him. They want to learn what makes him tick. What are his
memories.
Want
to study his genetics.
They also want to study his sexual responses. How he gets an erection. This is a movie this is a big budget movie that came out in the cinemas in 1974. And they're showing him pornography and mud wrestling to see if he has any physiological response.
I'm going to reach back into my glory years as an undergrad studying psychology. There is an actual device called a penile strain gauge, mm-hmm. which does what the name implies, which tests tumescent impulses, obviously, to stimuli. And what you have are subjects who are given a series of images, whether that be women in bikinis, men with rippling abs, children, animals, you name it. And then they see whether you get a physiological response below the belt, shall we say. And they show him, as you said, female mud wrestling. They showed topless women being felt up by these mysterious hands. And we said ourselves, geez, that's pretty exciting to me.
He wasn't, but...
Talk more slowly. Yeah.
What stimulated him was looking at the body of Consuela. And this is Charlotte Rampling, who was one of the immortals.
One of the elite, yeah.
And, or the elite. And, yeah, where do they go from there, man?
Where do we go from here? We have this agrarian society with all their needs met. A lot of them are these sort of effete little Lord Fauntleroy types, and they gather around these banquet tables. They have needs met. They just eat and drink.
But
they don't have sex.
You see, they're an agrarian society, but they're not producing anything.
No, they have others produce for them, which is what made me think this is some sort of extended analogy to the Cultural Revolution or to communism, where you have an elite who don't do anything mm-hmm. and the underclass produces for them and they reap the benefits, or feudalism. I don't know what. There's so many things happening in this ridiculous movie mm-hmm. where you have surpluses and needs, and these are meted out by some vortex and which decides what barley is harvested and what mill is put through the miller and who makes what and according to whom, and where do we go from here? There is a tension between this outsider, this
outlander
being Ich bin ein Ausländer, and whose pure id is brought into this society, who has no mm-hmm. impulses and no physiological responses to anything. They're just in effect robots,
right? And they want to study him. They want to know like what makes this brutalist, or what makes this this animal, as they call him,
tick. Yeah,
you know, he's violent, he rapes, and that's another thing that we learn, is that he was genetically engineered by Zardoz to be one of the few procreators in this weird society. And ultimately, when you have a utopia, which is really dystopia, you're going to have some sort of like revolution. And so there is a character who I believe his name was Friend, and he questions how they're utilizing Zed, and he gets the ultimate punishment. He gets aged 50 years,
yeah.
And he gets sent to this, I guess you would call it was almost like an old age home, where nobody dies, and all the while, Zed is, we get a little more backstory about Zed, and we realize he's not as one-dimensional as we originally thought. I mean, this is a man who at one point had a real crisis of conscience, because
it's so as I'm narrating this, I'm like, this is so fucking ridiculous. But,
you know, I'm learning as I go along.
He was going on this rampage, shooting up, you know, whomever, and he saw what he, the faceless man. And he ran into the domicile of the faceless man, and it happened to be a library. And in doing so, he started reading books. And he started gleaning knowledge. And one of those books was... Da-da-da!
Gail Frank Baum's Wizard of Oz.
And that made him realize that Zardoz had much more akin to the wizard in the Wizard of Oz than any real deity of any sort. So, all this leads to a revolution. A pulling back of the curtain, if you will, of this utopian, elitist, isolationist society. And revolution and realization and need to sort of realize that, you know, what we've created is not particularly advantageous or ideal as human beings are meant to grow old and perish.
Yeah.
La-di-da-di-da. But the reality of the matter is that, I mean, there are some interesting philosophical underpinnings to this movie. It is a sort of, it's an exploration of certain things. As you said before, it could be analogous to Communist China.
Mm-hmm.
It could be analogous to just, you know, humans' desire for knowledge or humans' desire for immortality, what have you. But it's all wrapped up in this package of ludicrousness.
I don't want to hear about any packages.
Well, we saw Dr. Carnes' package in this movie. Yes, indeed. And yes, there's a lot of references to packages. But it's wrapped up in this ludicrousness that I could say is awful, but yet it's not awful because I admire the ambition, the, I would say, almost hubris of John Boorman to put this on the screen. I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know what substances he was ingesting at the time, but this was something, this is beyond bizarre.
Yes, you have these old people shunted away into some sort of hermetically sealed Fellini-esque bubble, and they're pod people, and they're stuck in this containment apparatus. They're almost like throwaways, and the rest of the people can go live their lives as immortals, and the people who are punished are separated out, like this Fremt fellow. Is that his name? Fremt?
I thought it was Fremt.
Fremt? Okay, whatever he is. And at one point, Zed is trapped in this bubble as well, and he conveys to them that he can die, and of course, they are just immediately... They're immediately just captivated by this notion because they have to live with these old, decrepit bodies, and they want to get away and alleviate their immortality and their pain and suffering. And so that the denouement comes in where the entire society realizes that their structure, their banality, their lack of impulses, their lack of any sort of transcendent reality is going to come crashing down on them because they have no purpose to their lives at all other than they just exist and have all their immediate needs fulfilled with the banquets and the way they just carry on and just an easy lackadaisical existence. At the same time, there's something to be said for their existence too.
Okay.
Barbarian societies have civilized us in a way that we don't behave like Mongols rampaging all over Europe. Like you get settlements, you put people together, you grow livestock, you grow wheat and agriculture, and you are able to turn your attention to other thoughts. Whereas no marauding hunter-gatherer culture ever survives, because they're such a brutish, nasty, and short, you know, to quote
Hobbes,
mm-hmm. lifestyle, that these people don't create any culture. They don't have any means of doing what the Mayans did or doing what the Egyptians did. Like, they're always looking for the next conquest. So they have developed the extreme end of a society where everything is pre-planned, everything is predetermined, there's nothing left to chance.
Mm.
And they bring in this outsider who works more on impulse and id. So it's this great tension that
uh-huh.
brings together these two things.
Well, this is all, I mean, it's interesting, because they're trying to look for philosophical underpinnings and subtext and message in Zardoz. But let's talk about Zardoz as a piece of cinema. This is not a philosophical treatise.
No, it is not. There are vacuum-sealed nude people. There's people buried up to their necks in barley.
There's talking rings.
Yeah, everyone talks, I guess, telepathically through these gemstones on their fingers. There's a floating head that, I guess, encounters turbulence because it can't, like, sweep in for its descent, you know, as easily as you think it would. There's people who don masks inexplicably, and who knows how the brutalists survive other than, what do they do, just rape and pillage and conquest? They just, that's how they reproduce? They just, who knows?
Well, yeah, as I said before, Sean Connery was selectively bred to be one of the few that can actually procreate to create more brutalists, because they're not immortal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, visually, this film is a sumptuous banquet of what the fuck in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Whether it be, you know, the sartorial splendor of the brutalists, because they're all wearing codpieces.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that if you see one extra wearing a codpiece, okay, whatever. But when it's Sean Connery, it's just, it's incredulous that this man, I mean, this was in 1974.
During the peak of his box office draw.
Well,
all
not
the Bond
necessarily,
stuff.
Because, this is the thing, like, at this point, he had left the Bond franchise, came back, and then he left it again, and because of that, he was sort of considered box office poison. So Borman was able to get him on the cheap. And Sean Connery, at this point, you know, this was before his late career renaissance, films like Entrapment, and I don't know what other films, Spygate.
The Untouchables, or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was considered to be a has-been. So they managed to get this actor that we now look on as one of the great movie stars, and he was sort of like at the end of his rope, and he took this role. And, you know, it's funny, because in a lot of ways, and I mean, I guess this is flattering in a sense, because I've never listened to this podcast. How does it get made, or how did it get made? But I know it's a very popular podcast. Mm-hmm. We've been compared once or twice to that podcast. Youngster Media compared us to that podcast. And it's flattering, it says, one, because they're very popular, but they examine how these what-the-fuck movies got made. And when I think about this movie in the 70s, like, how did this get made? How did Borman get the funding? Where did this idea come from? How did he get these actors to agree to do this? And that's fascinating in amongst itself, much more so than what was put on screen. I just want to know, like, how did this all come together?
Yeah, considering it's almost impervious to an elevator pitch, there's no way you can convince anybody to watch this thing in one sentence. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. And if listeners want to correct us for any of the major plot points we've overlooked, email us reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. There's stuff that is mystifying to us, that's bewildering, and we can only imagine what the impact this would have had on audiences at the time, because we are watching it in order to talk about it. We're taking notes, such as they are. I stopped taking notes midway through. I was just so befuddled. But if you're just in a theater in 1974 watching this, there's just no way. Like, we had the same reaction to The Apple, this dystopian future run by a record company.
Well, I mean, I was thinking to myself as I was watching this was, if people thought that 2001 was inscrutable, yeah, it was. But it really wasn't, if you really think about it. I mean, there is a real sort of philosophical linear story that Kubrick was trying to say.
For sure.
And if there is any inscrutability in the narrative, that's compensated for by the virtuosic filmmaking, the music,
yes,
the cinematography, what have you. This makes 2001 look like,
yeah, Die Hard or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, as talented as Borman is, he's no Stanley Kubrick. So this is one of those movies that really make you ponder and go, like, wow, who greenlighted this thing? Were there any sort of, like, you know, producers coming by the set going,
focus testing, yeah.
Cover Sean Connery just a wee bit more. His ass cheeks are a little bit distracting. Yeah.
Maybe a little less toned down the fishnet raping and people buried to their necks in barley. Mm-hmm. And the millstoning, again, 75% less millstoning. Like, God, what is going on here? How would you have made this marketable in any sense?
The fact that a movie like this exists, and it has developed a cult following over the year. Many people enjoy it because of its sheer lunacy.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some people that actually look at it as sort of like a very sort of interesting cautionary tale about, you know, trying to create an elitist utopian society that which then becomes isolationist. And I recently watched a movie, I keep talking about this filmmaker over and over again, Ben Wheatley, and it was High Rise. And his movie all took place in a building. It was based on a novel by J.G. Ballard. And it all took place in a high-rise building.
Of crash fame, obviously. Exactly. And if anyone has a chance to check it out, have to check it out.
Yeah.
Where great novel, too.
The upper floors are the haves, the elite, mm-hmm. and the lower floors are the have-not. And eventually, there's sort of like a class struggle, and they meet, and what results is not, let's say, utopian in any way whatsoever. High Rise is wonderful, and as an IMDb,
that's interesting that the elites should live in the upper echelons of this structure. Because when you think about it, penthouses, obviously the one percenters live up there, but a lot of also the exurbs and the ghettos are housed in these container high rises. So it's interesting that would be a conception of it, but for sure as well, like the above and below, whether that was the castle in feudal times, it's an interesting conceit. I'm dying to check it out. Having just checked out Tenement, another high-rise horror-type film, man, I'm all about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited.
It's hard to
we both live in high-rises.
It's like Wheatley, Gerber, Finley,
yeah. And of course, Shivers, which takes place in a high-rise as well. So anything like that, Demons, of course, as well.
Well, no, but I mean, when I was scrolling through the trivia for Zardoz, and it said that Ben Wheatley actually considers Zardoz to be one of his favorite films. So I believe he got inspiration from Zardoz to make this masterpiece, High Rise. So, I mean, there's something there. This was my second viewing. I own the Blu-ray. I watched it one time just because I heard this was, so, you know, his reputation preceded it. I want to see Sean Connery in this sling suit. And don't ask me why, but I did. I thought, what the hell was I watching? I had to own the Blu-ray. Now I've seen it a second time. I still feel like I need to see it. It's like an onion. There's layers I need to keep pulling back. You know, and
I caught this thing on cable at 3 a.m. I ingested like a significant amount of hash, I should say, with my ex-girlfriend at the time. And seeing this testicular hammock and Sean Connery with his ponytail is like traipsing around the, I guess it turns out, Irish Highlands, wherever they filmed this debacle. And I thought, my God, like I was completely stupefied by that at the time, and having caught it midway, not even being able to tap into all these different subtleties that we're explicating here, and I just thought, okay, this is for sheer what the fuckedness. I watched the remainder of this thing just stoned out of my gourd, and now revisiting it relatively sober, I thought, relatively sober. Yeah, I thought, there's more going on here than meets the eye, and we can expand on that here with what did we learn. Should I start?
Yes.
Well, I learned that in this socialist utopia that the women all dress like washerwomen from a Vermeer portrait. And I was thinking from that art period, there's a scene where Zed is walking through a gallery and he picks up a Van Gogh painting and he sticks his finger right through the eyeball of it. And I thought, this is bizarre. The headdresses are straight out of the Mayflower. The sartorial sense is no better for a utopian society than the banana hammocks that the brutalists are sporting. What did you learn?
I learned that the 70s were a very unique decade. I was born in the 70s. I came of age in the 80s. The 80s, it was a wonderful decade to be a child. You know, we had great toys, great cartoons, great breakfast cereals. Mm-hmm. But there was something in the 70s. There was this real sense of artistic freedom. And watching this movie, and I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, this could not have been made in
any other decade.
Yeah. And there was something very, very unique about that time. I mean, we're coming out of, like, you know, the free love, hippie,
Altamont and Woodstock and all that stuff, yeah.
But the same, so you have that going up against the Vietnam era, and there's some very bizarre kind of dichotomy and juxtaposition and tension between the hippie movement, the Vietnam era, and what you're getting is this really kind of bizarre, idealistic, and very cynical art. A lot of that led to the punk movement, a lot of that led to crazy pieces of delirious entertainment like Zardoz, but I mean, the 70s was a very...
It's fertile ground for bizarre shit, whether it's this or Taxi Driver even, as a more mundane example, where you have just a guy with no backstory who just wants to clean up the streets, shoots everyone, the denouement has them just bodies bloodied in where they lie. The end. There's no hope.
So would that be your ideal double bill then? Zardoz and Ashton?
I think so. Okay. Maybe only because I wanted to shoot the entire cast of Zardoz after this. But no. We went into this with a set of expectations. And we can draw a line directly to the glorious, I guess, heralding of the Scientology religion that was Battlefield Earth. We went into it thinking, okay, this is ostensibly the worst film ever made. But it really isn't, because there's more going on here than meets the eye. In the case of Battlefield Earth, it was enslavement of humanity. Mm-hmm. And in the case of here, another type of enslavement. And there was way more. When you talk about the worst films of all time, which we frequently do, I offhandedly compared this to Manos, Hands of Fate. Because in Manos, there's nothing going on. There's no subtext. It's all text. It's a demonic figure with his man Friday doing evil in the desert. There's nothing beyond that. It's boring as fuck. The acting is terrible. It has just awful set pieces one after the other. It's 61 minutes. It feels like 3 hours. That could be very well the worst movie ever made. This thing has so much going for it, and I think I would like to revisit this.
Well, I was going to say the exact same thing. I mean, this being my second viewing now, yours too, but I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know if you can count your first.
Because, barely, yeah.
I feel like I owe it to myself and to John Boorman himself to watch this movie and to explore it a bit more and peel back some of these layers. There's something here. There's a lot of sort of like Bolivian marching powder inspired courses yes. that were made when they made this movie. But there's definitely some kernel of wisdom, and I need to watch it more to find out. So for that, I have to say that Zardoz is a movie that will get my recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And I'm going to give it 3 stars.
Likewise. Yeah, I did not remember or expect or anticipate all these little nods to eugenics and destiny and foreshadowing and free will and
free
utopianism.
Will versus determinism.
There's so much going on in this schlocky, ridiculous a hunk of cheese with floating head Mayan masks and fertility medieval ritual dancing and nudity and fornicating and violence. There's a lot going on beneath the surface.
Franco Bob illusions. So,
It's our Dawes, Wizard of Oz, and this is a little bit of wizardry on the part of Boorman. Hell, gotta hand it to him.
Yeah.
If you're gonna fail, fail spectacular. Yeah, for
exactly.
sure.
Exactly.
And for more,
check out our spectacular
website, www.reallyawfulmovies.
We hope not a failure of a website, but
we're reaching for the stars with that. And, of course, new episodes of the podcast every week. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.